Hello and welcome. You're listening to The Broadband Exchange, the podcast from your friends at Telecompetitor. I'm Ian Desher, Pivot's Director of Media and Story and Managing Editor of Telecompetitor. It's time to review this week's broadband news. Let's get into it. We'll begin with federal policy, where the FCC opened another chapter in its broader review of the Universal Service Fund. In its August 6th meeting last week, the Commission adopted a notice of proposed rulemaking aimed at strengthening USF management and the FCC's oversight of the Universal Service Administrative Company, or USAC. USAC has administered the fund since 1998, and the FCC noted that the organization has not undergone a comprehensive reform since then. The new proceeding seeks comment on current administrative processes, USAC's structure and responsibilities, operating costs, and the effect of USAC's board on program administration. The Commission also stressed a key boundary. USAC administers the rules, but it does not make policy or interpret unclear provisions on its own. Staying with federal programs, Telecompetitor spoke with National Rural Electric Cooperative Association CEO Jim Matheson about the fact that pole attachment requirements continue to complicate BEAD participation for some electric cooperatives. Under NTIA's revised terms, a cooperative that accepts BEAD money for any part of its territory can become subject to FCC pole attachment rules across its entire footprint, not only the portion involved in the funded deployment. The condition applies when those poles are not already regulated under state or federal law, and it remains in effect for the federal interest period. Those FCC rules cap certain rates and charges, establish application timelines, and can allow qualified contractors to perform some make-ready work. Electric cooperatives, however, have historically been exempt from federal pole attachment regulation under Section 224 of the Communications Act. Matheson told us 9 of the 62 electric cooperatives that initially qualified for BEAD funding have dropped out. He pointed to delays, rising costs, and pole attachment requirements, with some withdrawals tied specifically to the rate issue. His blunt summary was, "The juice isn't worth the squeeze." Meanwhile, some new Massachusetts grants are focusing on what happens after broadband reaches a building. The Healy-Driscoll Administration and the Massachusetts Broadband Institute announced nearly $1.5 million for 10 public and affordable housing organizations through the Retrofit Ancillary Grantee, or RANGE, program. The grants will support residents and properties that already received internet upgrades through the state's Residential Retrofit Program. Recipients can use the money for device distribution, digital literacy, digital navigation, and tenant coordination, and improvements to public spaces. After this award round, RANGE has distributed a total of $8.9 million to 45 housing organizations statewide. Now to wireless, where AT&T launched what it described as the first nationwide 5G standalone core dedicated to public safety. The FirstNet core was built separately from AT&T's commercial network core, giving public safety users greater operational control and an added layer of separation for security and reliability. AT&T said it will support faster uploads and improved responsiveness, while multiple geographically distributed core sites will provide additional redundancy. Access is limited to FirstNet SIMs, and a dedicated security operations center monitors the core around the clock. The architecture also creates the foundation for adaptive mission performance, which is intended to tailor network behavior for applications such as body-worn cameras, mission-critical communications, and live video. FirstNet subscribers have already begun migrating at no additional cost, although compatible devices and plans are required and availability is not universal. Speaking of wireless, a new J.D. Power study found that wireless customer satisfaction is moving in the right direction overall. The industry's average score rose 10 points since the same study was done last January, reaching 626 on a 1,000-point scale. Problem resolution and perceived value posted some of the largest gains. T-Mobile ranked highest among both postpaid and prepaid mobile network operators for a third consecutive study volume. Consumer Cellular led postpaid MVNOs, while Mint Mobile led the prepaid MVNO category. According to the report, 45% of phone-based support interactions involved an AI assistant, and those assistants revolved the request in 48% of the cases. When the AI worked, satisfaction rose sharply. When it failed and the customer still needed a human, the experience suffered. Apparently, customers like automation best when it actually automates something. T-Mobile also introduced a new way to spread out the cost of a device last week. Its EIP Flex 36 option lets new and existing customers finance an eligible device, taxes, and checkout fees over 36 months. Well-qualified customers can leave with nothing due at the sale, and the company is offering 0% APR for a limited time. The fine print allows rates from 0 to 24% based on creditworthiness, so zero upfront doesn't, of course, mean free phone. T-Mobile also extended its standard 0% financing to 36 months and refreshed several service plans. New student perks options start at $30 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees, and students can bundle 5G home internet for another $30 per month, all of courses just in time for the back-to-school season. That longer financing window arrived as the global smartphone market contracted. In a new report, Omdia estimated that second quarter smartphone shipments fell 6% year over year to 272 million units, with memory prices and other component costs putting pressure on the market. Samsung remained the largest vendor with 60.5 million shipments, up 5%. Apple posted its strongest second quarter, shipping 55.1 million iPhones, a gain of 23%. The pressure was more visible among vendors with heavier exposure to lower-priced devices. Omdia expects vendors to place more emphasis on margins and average selling prices along with financing, trade-ins, and bundles. And of course, that makes the T-Mobile announcement part of a larger industry response to increasingly expensive hardware. Moving along, last week SpaceX outlined a much larger role for Starlink in both broadband and mobile service. In a letter to Canadian regulators, the company reported second quarter revenue of $7.8 billion. Its connectivity business generated $4.3 billion, up 66% year over year, and Starlink ended the quarter with 12 million subscribers, which is twice the total from the previous year. On the broadband side, SpaceX said each Starlink V3 satellite will be about 10 times more capable than a V2 satellite, and SpaceX expects to launch about 10 times as many of those. They are projecting roughly 100 times more delivered bandwidth. SpaceX expects to have at least 1,000 V3 satellites in orbit by the second quarter of 2027. SpaceX also renamed its direct-to-cell capability Starlink Mobile and said it planned to begin launching second-generation mobile satellites in 2027, with service expected by the end of that year. The next system is expected to use 65 MHz of EchoStar spectrum, compared with 5 MHz today. SpaceX President and COO Gwynne Shotwell said the next mobile constellation could contain roughly 10 times the current total of about 650 satellites, and she described the combined upgrade as potentially 100 times better than today's service. The company also discussed a terrestrial component built around large numbers of smaller cellular base stations. SpaceX made no secret of its ambition to challenge AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, which means satellite-to-device service is moving from an emergency coverage feature toward a more direct form of wireless competition. Next, a cybersecurity report found elevated external risk indicators across much of the U.S. telecom sector. SureShield and BorderHawk analyzed public, non-intrusive data associated with 3,106 operators. The report placed 66% of them in a high or critical composite risk band. It found signs consistent with subdomain takeover risk at 41% of telecom operators, associations with vulnerabilities on CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities catalog at 39%, and weak SPF configurations at more than 1,200 operators. The report did not name or grade specific companies. The authors described the results as directional indicators of systemic exposure. Even with that caveat, they said the pattern points to the fact that known vulnerabilities, dangling DNS records, and weak email authentication can create dangerous risks even before an attacker needs to try a novel approach. A DKIX survey found a different kind of network readiness gap in enterprise cloud environments. Among more than 400 IT and infrastructure decision makers in the United States and the UK, that DKIX surveyed, 96% said their networks were ready to support cloud and AI initiatives over the next 2 years. At the same time, their teams spent an average of 11.5 hours every week resolving cloud connectivity problems, and 49% spent more than 10 hours. Latency between cloud environments, security vulnerabilities, and DDoS attacks, and downtime or reliability issues were among the leading concerns. 61% of respondents already use private cloud connectivity, and another 31% are considering it. The survey noted that AI investment begins with compute, but its performance still depends on predictable routes, including the cloud, and that seems to be the biggest problem at the moment. We'll finish in rural Utah, where Centricom acquired Gunnison Telephone Company. The transaction officially closed on July 1st, subject to customary regulatory approvals, and Centricom announced it at the end of July. Gunnison Telephone had served Gunnison, Centerfield, Mayfield, Fayette, and nearby unincorporated areas for more than a century. Its network included fiber to the premises, copper, and fixed wireless, reaching about 6,700 residents in just over 1,500 households. Centricom, the operating name of Central Utah Telephone Inc., also traces its roots to 1903 and now runs a statewide fiber network. The companies said that the combination will pair Centricom's broad network with Gunnison's local infrastructure, customer relationships, and community presence. Gunnison was previously a subsidiary of Licht Corporation. And that is it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to the Broadband Exchange. You can read all the articles we talked about today at telecompetitor.com. Feel free to drop us a line while you're there. Thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next week.